Shayna here with another entertaining episode of the Adventure Options Podcast. You want adventures and you have options. In this episode, I interview Tyler Davis, one of the managers of the Angama Mara Lodge. Tyler was born into adventure. Listen to find out who's been sneaking through camp. This podcast is sponsored by Adventure Writers, copywriting for the travel industry. There are 4.6 billion web pages out there. Make sure yours stands out. Go to adventurewriters.agency for help. That's adventure, WRITERS.agency. Now for the show. Tyler, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much, Shayna. Nice to be here with you.
Yeah, well, kind of be here with me. You're clear across the world. Why don't you tell everybody where you are talking to me from?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm in the middle of a Maasai Mara in Kenya.
In Kenya, very nice. And you are one of the regional directors of a safari lodge there, is that correct?
That's right. So my wife and I share the role of regional director of Angama Mara, which is a beautiful luxury lodge. It's perched up on an escarpment that overlooks the Maasai Mara.
That's awesome. Let's talk about that in a little bit. Why don't we get started with how you got into the adventure travel industry?
Sure. The long version starts in my childhood, and that my parents were born travelers, and they got me hooked. Was a trip that they pulled me out of school for an entire year, and just took me traveling around the world for a year. And we set off west from Seattle, and just kept chasing the sun for a year. And that sparked in me a lifelong interest for travel. Kind of gave me a case of incurably itchy feet, and have been doing it ever since. And that has progressively led to various jobs in the industry, to looking for opportunities to travel. And I have, been very lucky to be able to keep doing that throughout my life.
So what would you say was your first, like, quote, real job in the adventure travel industry?
My first real job was my first job out of college. So after graduating, I went to school on the East Coast. I came back for a job close to home, relatively close to home. I went up to the San Juan Islands and was a kayak guide out of Friday and Roche Harbors on San Juan Island for a summer. Kind of a fun thing to do out of college, be a kayak bum. But it was actually a job that I really enjoyed because it allowed me to do something that I always wanted to do, which was be a guide, a real guide. From that trip that I took when I was 12, 13 years old, we went to South Africa and Namibia, and I fell in love with the idea of becoming a safari guide. That was my dream job. So for having the opportunity to be some kind of guide anyway, straight out of college, was really exciting for me. Cause I've always enjoyed trying to connect people with nature and also interpreting nature, and natural history and cultural history, in sort of an educational way. So that was my first real job in the space out of college, and one that led to a whole lot of other great things.
Now, was that with Evergreen Escapes, or was that before Evergreen Escapes?
So that was before Evergreen Escapes, but it led to Evergreen Escapes. So it seems like all roads lead to Evergreen Escapes one way or another. But
it kind of feels like that on this podcast. I can hardly interview somebody who doesn't have some kind of connection to Evergreen Escapes.
Yeah, exactly. So the company that I worked for there at the time was called San Juan Safaris, later became San Juan Outfitters. But the gentleman who was the general manager at the time and is now the owner of that company, at the end of that season, I'd asked him, is there anybody that's doing this kind of thing but based in Seattle? Because while I love living in the San Juan Islands, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, she was living in Seattle. And even though it's not that far away, the way the crow flies, it's still like a 5-hour trip to get between, from door to door, Seattle to the San Juan. So we're close, but still a long distance relationship. And I wanted to be based in Seattle. So he said, yeah, I know this guy. His name is Jay Coppert, and he runs a company called Evergreen Escapes. Why don't you try getting in touch with him? And that was early days for Evergreen Escapes. And I did make the connection, got a chance to talk to Jake. We got to know each other a little bit, and that eventually led to an opportunity to work with Evergreen Escapes, actually in a pretty unusual way to start.
How long were you there?
I was with Evergreen Escapes for, I think, pretty close to 5 years.
So then what led to you leaving Evergreen Escapes, and what was your next adventure after that?
It was this. It was coming to Kenya. So
That seems like quite the leap from the Pacific Northwest to Kenya.
Yeah, I get that response a lot. it is a pretty big leap, but I've been in love with Africa for a long time and wanted to, and I kind of had my eye on and my brain on, you know, what could get a little more permanently than the infrequent trips I was making for travel, for fun. I wanted to be here. And my wife, Shannon, she got bit by the Africa bug back in 2008 when we went on safari together for fun in South Africa for 2 weeks. And it became this thing that we would talk about over a glass of wine or three at night. How cool would it be to just quit everything and run off to the bush and live in Africa for a while? And it got to a point where we thought, well, maybe we can actually do this. I've made a lot of connections in the industry, a lot of really good friends, and figured, well, it's such a, you know, the adventure travel industry is such a, it's such a brotherhood, such a familial type of environment. People are really friendly and helpful, willing to help each other. That I knew that if we put our minds to it and talk to the right people, something would eventually come up. So we quit our job. She was a nurse at Seattle Children's Hospital, and I was working for Evergreen Escapes. And we thought, okay, let's make the leap. And so we actually quit our jobs without having found anything quite yet. We did find jobs as ski instructors in Crested Butte, Colorado for winter, because we thought, all right, this might take a little while. Could take about 4 to 6 months to find something. That seems like a perfect amount of time to go be ski bums. Let's give that a go. And then about 2 weeks after we got the ski instructor jobs, we got put in touch with Nikki Fitzgerald, who is the owner here at Angama. It's complete serendipity, getting hooked up with the right people at the right time.
I think if I was going to run away to Africa, I would definitely want a nurse to go with me. So I think that's awesome that she has that skill set to match yours. And Crested Butte is wonderful. I lived in Colorado for 10 years and I'm very familiar with the ski hills there. That's really cool.
Yeah, I'm a little bit bummed we actually never made it there to live in Crested Butte and be ski instructors. We thought we would, but you know, this came up so quickly, which we obviously were thankful for. But we never made it there. So maybe that's later in life we'll be ski bums.
Well, and I imagine the owners were a little bummed you didn't make it there either. So tell me about what was the name of the owner of the Angama? What's her name?
So the owners are Steve and Nikki Fitzgerald. They are the brains behind this.
So tell me what it's like working with them.
Yeah, it's really special. So this is a standalone family run lodge. It really is like a family run lodge. We are the owners and founders are Steve and Nikki Fitzgerald, with their business partner, Steve Mitchell. There's a lot of us working together who are family. So, Steve and Nikki's daughter Kate is part of the business. She runs the sales and marketing. Steve Mitchell's wife Allie is also involved with the marketing. My wife Shannon, we share the role 50-50 as the regional directors. We've had a garden built or designed by Steve Mitchell's brother-in-law. It's very much a family business. Just from that perspective alone, this is a very special thing to be a part of, because it's got a good vibe. It's got a good culture. We're working on this together. There's a lot of difficulties with running a lodge this size, but not with the people that we work with, which makes it very, very easy.
I have never been to Kenya, so kind of describe it for me and maybe any of our listeners who have never been there, what it's like, what the temperatures are like, what the surroundings like, what the lodge is like, stuff like that.
Kenya is the home of African safaris. This is where African safaris started, and it's actually quite a diverse country. It's not that big in terms of country sizes, but it's extremely diverse, and there's an awful lot to do here. Where I'm based in the Maasai Mara, we're actually at about 6,000 feet elevation. So even though we're 1 degree south of the equator, we have a pretty temperate climate where it doesn't ever get too hot, doesn't ever get too cold. We do have a bimodal rainy season, which means we have really fun weather to watch twice a year. I'm in shorts and a t-shirt all day. Never really have to worry about getting caught out in the cold. But the safaris here is what people come for. And it's quite a good destination for safaris because of the ease of access. In fact, starting at the end of October, there's going to be direct flights from New York. That's a game changer for safaris in East Africa. So New York to Nairobi will be a direct flight. And then once you get here, it's extremely easy to get around Kenya. Really good infrastructure with roads, travel by road and travel by plane around Kenya to get to the various destinations. The big draw is the game. The Maasai Mara is one of the best game reserves in the world for ease of access to game. If not the best. There are, you know, competition for the Maasai Mara around Africa would be the other big game reserves that you may have heard of, like Kruger National Park is a big one. And here, I think the big difference is we can go out at pretty much any time of the day and see wildlife. We're very lucky in that regard. A lot of other safari destinations, you kind of have to focus on the morning and the evening to see the wildlife, maybe because it's too hot in the middle of the day, either for the people to be out or for the animals to be out. But here we get to experience it all day long, and we're quite spoiled in that regard. One of the biggest draws for the Maasai Mara specifically is the migration, the great migration, which I think everybody knows about. And we get very, very busy that time of year. Now, the secret of the Maasai Mara is that we have wildlife here year round. So I think that there's kind of a misconception that when the wildebeest leave, which will be coming up now towards the end of October into November, that's when the wildebeest start heading south again, that all the animals disappear with them. And that's not the case. So we're a very seasonal destination, right now, but we shouldn't be. That's the secret. That's what people should know about Kenya and the Maasai Mara, is that this is a year-round destination to come. And actually, the best times of year are probably the time you think not to come.
Well, I imagine for another reason too would be that there's not a ton of other tourists there. If you go in, quote, the off season, you probably get a little bit more intimate view when you're on those safaris. So this might be my anxiety talking, but how friendly are these animals with the lodge itself?
Yeah, we're unfenced. So yeah, we have close neighbors. Not that long ago, we had elephants walking through camp. There's certain times of the year that elephants seem to be in camp almost every single night. Leopards, I'm sure, are in camp almost every single night. We don't even know it. They're just so secretive. We know when the lions come through. The lions will be coming through camp occasionally. You know, where we are, we're right at the edge of the Maasai Mara National Reserve. So you stick your hand out of your tent and you're in the reserve, but we're just outside where the property is. So we look down into the reserve, and we're about 1,000 feet up above the Mara floor. So we have incredible views from where we're perched. Most of the animals stay down there. They don't want to climb that 1,000 feet, but they do occasionally. They do come up, and we get them in camp, and actually it makes it quite exciting. We have a good team of askaris, which is a Swahili word for guard, and they know where every animal is at any moment within the camp. So we're perfectly safe, but it has a nice bush feel to it.
Yeah, that does sound exciting. You said that people fly into Nairobi when they're coming there. How far away is the lodge from Nairobi?
So we are, we're not that far away. It's about, it's about 120 miles to the west of Nairobi. Most of our guests get here by plane. So it's about a 45 minute flight in a Cessna Caravan. And that's the way most guests will get here. If you decide to drive, again, not that far, but some of the roads aren't the best. So it takes about 7 hours to get here by road, but the flight's quick, it's easy, it's quite scenic, which is nice. And Yeah, once you get to the Mara ecosystem on your way in, you're looking down out of the plane, you're seeing elephants. If it's during migration season, you'll see the wildebeest. There's always giraffes, zebra. You get to see all that from, it's like a scenic flight for, you know, as part of your experience getting here, you get a free scenic flight. So yeah, it's a special place to even just to arrive in, landing on a dirt airstrip and seeing giraffe and zebra out the window as you're pulling up to the safari vehicles that meet you and whisk you away to the lodge.
Oh, I can't imagine how fun that would be and how excited it would make you for your entire trip when it starts with something that exciting. Why don't you tell me about some of the activities that you do there at the lodge?
Yeah, obviously the biggest draw is getting out in a vehicle on safari down into the Maasai Mara. And that is what everybody will do at some point during their stay. Guests who are bush crazy will do it from dawn till dusk every single day. They're out there, they're looking for the lions, the leopards, the rhinos, the cheetah. And they're spending all day doing that. And we send them out with picnic lunch, picnic breakfast, and they can spend all day out there. But this is also a place to kind of come and relax. A lot of people use Ungama as a last stop of their trip because you can sit on your deck at Ungama and just admire the view without feeling guilty for not going on safari. The views are incredible, and you can see game. We've seen the big five from our decks. Big five is rhino, buffalo, elephant, leopard, and lion. And yeah, you can be sitting on your deck with a G&T, gin and tonic, and see those things among everything else. But for guests that want a little bit different experience in the bush, I think the best thing to do is actually get out on foot. And we have really fantastic walking safaris from here. They don't go down into the reserve, but they traverse the reserve's boundary just along the top of the escarpment here. And that's done with a Maasai naturalist. So we're in Maasai lands. All of our immediate neighbors are Maasai, and a lot of our staff are Maasai. And so we do our walking safaris with a couple Maasai naturalists who grew up right here. And our neighbors. And so they know every plant, they know every insect, every bird. And of course, just learning about the Maasai culture is fascinating, which you do on a safari like that, a walking safari. On that note, there are cultural experiences to have. You can visit a Maasai village nearby. Actually, go inside a working village, learn about what daily life is like for finding water, which kind of plants they collect food or medicine from, and learn more about their kind of visual culture as well, the dancing, the singing, the beadwork, all of that fun stuff, which is fascinating and a big component of a safari to East Africa. So for people who are a little more adventurous, want to do something a little bit different, there is hot air ballooning, which for me is a must not miss. That's something that every guest should do who comes to the Maasai Mara. And that's not just because ballooning, of course, is fascinating, but it's unusual and probably special places in the world to do it. And I haven't been around the world ballooning, but I have spoken to all the pilots here who, for them, this is the place to end up in your career as a balloon pilot, is the Maasai Mara. That's because of the consistency of the winds. Very few days the balloons have to stay on the ground because of poor weather. They're up like 350 to 360 days a year. And then just the things you see, you know, are incredible. To be able to float above a herd of elephants, to be able to just float calmly over the Mara River and look down and see hippos and crocodiles in the river. The number of times I've gone ballooning and just seen lions from as I'm sitting in the basket looking down is more often than not. So it's a really good, really special place to go ballooning. And ballooning itself is unusual for anybody who's never done it. It's a surreal experience because you're moving at the speed of the wind. There's no sound of winds. You're moving at the same speed. The only thing you hear are the burners that go on every so often to keep the hot air balloon afloat. So it's just very calm and serene, and it's at sunrise. And it's a great way to start the day. We've had some guests who do it on their first day. It's the first time they've done it, and they do it each successive morning thereafter because it's such a special experience.
Oh man, Tyler, I love living in the Pacific Northwest, but the way you're describing it, I just want to come to Kenya. So last week I interviewed Joe Hendricks, who is the founder of Travel Without Plastic. And while I was on her site, I noticed that Angamamara is part of her people that have signed up to be a lodge that is trying to reduce the amount of single-use plastic. Do you want to go ahead and tell me what Angamamara's role is in that and what they've done to reduce their single-use plastic?
Yeah, happily. I'd love to share a story. So we so we have a weekly blog, and I just wrote a blog a couple of weeks ago about how we've been 1 year plastic free. And from the outset of building Angama, starting Angama, we've endeavored to use as little single-use plastics as possible. But particularly in the last year, we've taken a step farther, and there's very little single-use plastic that you'll find on site. There are some things that are inevitable that will come from Nairobi as packaging, but we're trying to work with suppliers to cut down on that as well. But for us here, we make a concerted effort to use as little as possible. And I think probably the biggest and best example of that is water bottles. A lot of people travel anywhere in the world, but especially to developing countries, especially to Africa, being very scared about and nervous about, anxious about water, and knowing that water is coming from a safe source. Therefore, plastic water bottles get used an awful amount, and you see them everywhere. And so we knew that if we could target that one specific thing to start with, then that would be one of the biggest impacts we could make from removing ourselves from our dependency on single-use plastic. So to start, even from day one, we've had a water treatment plant here, a pretty big industrial one that treats our water source through one round. So that's the water that we can shower with and brush our teeth with, and that's fine. Those of us that live here, we can drink it. We've gotten enough used to the minerals and stuff that are still in it that it's fine to drink. But then from there, we actually put it through a secondary filtration system called Natura that then produces bottled water, essentially. And we have glass bottles. In fact, here's one right here. So I know our listeners can't see it, but you can see it. Every single guest who comes to Angama will have these bottles in their room. They'll have the bottles in the guest area. They'll have the bottles on their game drives. At the bottling plant, we have a little room where there's an industrial washer for the bottles. There's a cool little machine that has three different taps. There's cold still water, there's room temperature still water, and there's sparkling water. When the water is tested, it comes out cleaner than bottled water. You know, one of the big news stories with bottled water, plastic bottled water recently, is that there's plastic in the plastic bottled water. Go figure. Shocking, right? So as you drink the water from a plastic water bottle, you're actually ingesting plastic as well. And our water, which comes from a water source here in the middle of Africa, is cleaner than that. And in doing so, we have cut down on dependency on plastic water bottles dramatically. We don't see plastic water bottles here anymore. And when we do, we find a use for them. So we try to kind of complete the circuit and not having to throw away plastic water bottles. And we do that by finding other single-use plastics. Maybe it's trash we found on the ground. Maybe it's some of that packaging that's come from Nairobi that we're working on our suppliers with but haven't gotten there yet. We take that plastic, compress it and shove it into a water bottle. And as you shove more and more plastic, or maybe it's used aluminum foil, other things that just are waste that can't be recycled or properly thrown away, you stick them in water bottles and you pack it down tight enough and have this wonderful little brick that's called an eco brick. And so we have, our staff has, we have a little competition and they have created probably close to 1,000 of these eco bricks now. And with those eco bricks, we're using them in our garden, which we call the Shamba, to build raised beds. So we're actually putting the eco bricks to use. And in doing so, we are capturing all that single use plastic in a way that it's not getting out into the environment. It can actually be reused if we were to knock down those single beds. Unlike if we'd use regular bricks, which would break, those plastic bricks can actually be reused again as well. So we're trying to think full circle and some things are just inescapable, but even those we're working on. And that takes some time, that takes some building relationships, maintaining relationships with suppliers, maybe even doing the work for them and finding out what alternatives are. But those are all things that we're committed to because we see the issues. You see the issues in Africa quite a bit with single-use plastics and dependency on them and the problems they can cause. If you pass through rural towns in some parts of not just Kenya, but elsewhere in Africa, you'll see the plastic bags on the side of the road or the plastic water bottles, and it can become a big problem. Kenya is trying to make a difference as a whole, which is great. They a year ago outlawed plastic bags, single-use plastic bags from grocery stores, and that's made a huge difference. You don't see nearly as many plastic bags on the side of the road anymore, and other countries are following suit, which is exciting.
I really commend you and your efforts on that, because I imagine also there's a little bit of customer education that you have to do in letting your guests know that the water is safe, that it's not something that they need to be worried about, and that, yes, they can brush their teeth and stuff like that. And so I'm sure it's a bit of a headache and an extra chore, but I really commend you guys in taking on that effort.
Yeah, thank you. You're 100% right. There's definitely some education that needs to be done. Africa is a scary place to a lot of people, and it really doesn't need to be. I think that there's a lot of misinformation and selective hearing when it comes to what people hear about, you know, not just Africa, but the world at large. Yeah, this is a much more accessible and livable place than many people think, and that goes for the whole of Africa, not just here in Kenya, not just South Africa, which is obviously very accessible to people, but even off the beaten track destinations. I was just in Congo earlier last month, and I was amazed by how accessible Congo was. Which, as an American growing up, you hear the word Congo, you're like, well, that's not a place I'm ever going to go. But I've been to both Congos, and they're.
I'll admit that the Congo even scares me. I was talking with Jeff Manchester from Intrepid, and he was talking about how he drove through the Congo back in the 80s, which was part of the inspiration of starting Intrepid. And I think I said to him, I don't think I would do that. So I definitely am probably part of the misinformation on a specifically that part of Africa. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I think it's really cool that places like yours, like Angama, are showing people really the beauty that Africa has, specifically Kenya, but Africa in general, and showing them that it is safe and that it is a part of the world that can bring you a lot of joy and exploration. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, thanks. It is very cool to know that there are these places that, speaking from the adventure travel standpoint, that are destinations that are adventurous, but easy to get to, easy to get around, and easy to come home at the end of a trip with lots of stories to tell, lots of memories to share.
Tyler, it has been super exciting talking to you. Like I said earlier, you make me want to leave the Pacific Northwest and come to Kenya, which doesn't happen very often because I very much love it here. But I always end the podcast asking my guests two questions. And it's usually, where's your favorite place to go on an adventure? But I'm going to modify that one a little bit for you. I'm going to ask you, what's your favorite part about Kenya? And it could be something that you do there at the lodge, or it could be something totally separate. And then the second part is, what would be your advice to today's traveler? Just any advice you want to give today's adventure traveler.
Great questions. Fun questions. For me, I'm absolutely bush crazy. I've always been a natural history. So getting out in the bush, going on safari, that's just about my favorite thing to do in the whole world. But my favorite part about Kenya is having the ability to do that. Well, especially living here, it's on my doorstep. I'm spoiled rotten in that I have that luxury. But I get to do it with very special people. The best thing about Kenya is the people. And I think this is the hidden gem of Kenya. So you'll see it in comments on TripAdvisor and our feedback book all the time. People come here for the game. They come here for the wildlife. They want to stay for the people. There's an innate hospitality within all Kenyans that is unlike almost anywhere else in Africa. So for me, my favorite part about being here and my favorite thing to do here is just to get out, go on safari, see the wildlife, but meet more of and make more Kenyan friends. They're very, very special people, and I'm very fortunate to be here living and working with them. So that's the first question. The next question, my advice for travelers, we talked a little bit about this earlier, and I think that and this is especially true for adventure travel. But I think I know it applies to all travelers, and that is that the so-called off season, which here in the Mar we call the standard season, is the golden time to look to travel. There are so many perks to traveling in a so-called off season, and you know, there are reasons that the off season becomes the off season in the industry, but those reasons often are unfounded. For us here in Kenya, in the Maasai Mara, there's a rainy season. That term, just even saying the word rain when it comes to travel, it's like no go. But the fact of the matter is, that's the best time of year to be here, in my opinion. There's nothing better than the rainy season, and that's because it's not raining all day long every day for the whole of the rainy season. But that might be what you think when you hear the term, and nobody takes the time to explain it to you. In fact, what happens here during the rainy season is that from the morning, the moment you wake up, it's a big, beautiful blue sky. You have the day ahead of you. You can go out on a game drive. You can experience the Maasai Mara. In the evening, the clouds start to build, and you have this torrential, powerful rainstorm, thunder and lightning, heavy, heavy rain for an hour or two in the afternoon. Very dramatic, especially from where we are. We get to watch it, which is quite a powerful experience. And then it's done. It clears up by nightfall. You get to see the stars again. And because everybody has this perception of the rainy season being it's too wet, it's not fun, it's not good, there's very few people here. So what ends up happening then is that you have this amazing place to yourself. You're still getting the full experience. You're being doted on by a large team of incredibly hospitable people. You get sightings to yourself. And also on the flip side, by being here that time of year, you're supporting an industry that struggles with seasonality and the people who are affected by that. Yeah, there is an employment issue with seasonality, and that is because during the slower times of the year, it's harder to keep people employed full time. At Angama, we make a commitment to keeping people employed throughout the year because it's the right thing to do. But we can afford that ability because we're a little bit bigger lodge. At smaller camps during the slow season, a lot of people are contract work, and half the year they're out of a job. And so I think it's important for travelers to understand that by coming to the off season, not only are you discovering a time of the year that is actually probably the hidden gem of traveling to a destination, but you are giving back in a big way to that destination, more so than you would be during a peak season.
I have never thought of that as far as the off season, as far as how it affects the employees and the seasonal employees there. So I really appreciate that piece of advice. Tyler, you can tell that you love your job, that you love the Angama Mara, and that you love Kenya. And I really hope to get the chance to go there someday. I just think that's awesome. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for coming on the podcast. And everyone, go sign up for the standard season. Is that what you called it?
That's right. Standard
season.
Come visit us then.
Angama, and go visit Tyler.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Shane. It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me. And hopefully maybe there's an interview number two and it's here. You can come do it here.
There we go.
Shana here. Man, you can tell that Tyler loves his job, his guests, and his family in Kenya. I have walked away with a new outlook on the off season. Remember to visit adventurewriters.agency to join my mailing list and get updates when a new podcast episode airs. Until next time, kwaheri.